You like beef and I meat?
I love beef, man. Like I love meat. A good steak. You?
No.
No. Mm-mm. You went vegan a while ago, right?
Yeah, I'm vegan now, but I can't. You know what? When I eat a lot of meat, it hurts when I fucking shit. I can't shit when I eat a lot of meat. I can't fucking shit.
You know what I think the solution to that is?
What?
Don't eat meat.
You know, if I can't fuck shit, but if I can't shit, fuck! Fuck!
Hey everybody, welcome to a special edition of Hot Boxing. I'm Evan Britton.
And I'm Mike Tyson.
Mike, we got a great guest today, man.
Awesome guest.
Exciting.
Very awesome. This is very interesting guest we have
here. Yeah, it takes a lot to get me out on a Saturday morning.
I love
to do a podcast.
Thank you.
And
we
not just podcast,
that.
But also to Hotbox. But I would like, I do this, I, you know, I come in here Sunday midnight, you know, 3 in the morning. Tell me
where
when
you,
to come, I'm here.
I love that. John Heilemann, everybody.
Thank you, guys. It's just awesome to be here. This is, I've been looking forward to this day ever since we started talking about doing it. So here we are. And I grew up here, man. Not in El Segundo, but in fact, you know, my dad moved here from the Midwest in the late 50s. He was from Milwaukee, and when he moved out to California, the first job he had when he moved to LA was working for Litton Industries, a aerospace firm in El Segundo. So we're like, this is like, feels like I'm in my ancestral spiritual home. But I grew up in the Valley, out in the far West Valley, out near in Canoga Park.
Nice, man.
So that's my awesome. And I was here for the first 18 years of my life, and then left and have not lived here since, but I come back a lot. So LA always feels like my original.
Where do you live now?
I live in New York City.
Okay.
Yeah. Love it out there now, huh?
So, you know, I moved from here, your current home, to your old home. And in fact, when I moved to New York in 2002, 2003 was in Fort Greene.
That's where I was born, where my dad lived.
Yeah.
So, Cumberland Hospital.
Yeah. So I lived right on the park, right on
Washington Park.
Right on Washington Park. Yeah. I lived at 209 Washington Park on the corner.
No shit. My dad lives at 208 Washington Park.
Oh, no.
Fuck. That's crazy, man. That's amazing.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, no.
So my wife and I lived there right on the corner of Washington Park and DeKalb, like right across from the park.
I live on the Franklin between DeKalb and Willoughby.
Yeah, and you know, that park, as you know, man, like now it's all gentrified. And so the park is great. You can go and hang out there with the dogs and everybody all day, all night. It's great.
And it's beautiful.
And 15 years before, 20 years before, you could not go in that park.
I remember around 1977, they were filming a movie. It was around 77, 76, I guess, the Education of Sonny Carson or something. And they had all the gang fight pictures in Washington Park. Mm. As a little kid, we all went down there.
Yeah, wow.
Man, that's it used to not be that. That was not a place you went at night.
No, scary.
Not a
real
place.
Scary. North Portland Avenue, South Portland.
Yeah, it's crazy how that whole part of Brooklyn, you know, the Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, Bed-Stuy.
If you weren't like white or Puerto Rican or Italian, you better not go around there.
Yeah, right. Now, you know? not the case now. It's it's nice. It's actually one of the great, like, as that's that there's some places in Brooklyn that obviously totally gentrified, but that neighborhood. Still, that whole complex over there, Bed-Stuy, Clinton Hill, Brownsville still has the
Brownsville. we got to change the name.
Yeah, right.
The name is bad. It brings up so much stuff from the past.
But it's a nice mix over there. A lot of Brooklyn now. It's like you got these nice neighborhoods where it's like, you know, half, you know.
You don't have to worry about somebody snatching your head off or something.
That's true. And that's probably a good thing. But you lived there when it was a lot tougher.
Holy moly. Listen, when I go to Nassau, was my life a lie?
Yeah.
Was that actually true? Did I live like this? This is not a place that somebody that had nothing and weighs on welfare and it's just unbelievable what they did there.
How do you like California?
California is God's country.
Yeah. How long you lived here now?
I lived here before. I moved back here a year ago, but I lived here before in 87.
Right.
88.
And you moved back out here when?
Last year.
Last year.
Yes.
Right. And so you're this is it. You're here. You're done. California's going to be your home forever now.
It appears that way, but I don't know.
You look at home here.
I am at home here, but you just never know what the energy has in store for you.
He's got this shirt. That's a shirt of a person who's
LA guy.
That's an LA shirt, is what that is, right?
Exactly, for sure. Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome, man. I did the opposite. I was born in New York City.
Yeah.
Lived in Park Slope till I was 10. Then my mom moved my brother and I out to LA. lived in Burbank.
Burbank.
Right down the 101 from you, man.
Yeah.
Listen, if you lived in New York, you wouldn't have this Zen energy, man. You'd be a great.
I know. I might have just turned into a weed dealer if I had stayed.
I think it's the path. I mean, like, I think that they, both places are great, and they have great energy, and it's kind of great, too. I don't know. I always feel like I have become such a New Yorker, but I still have that California thing, like, down. You know, it's like people in New York still – there's, like, the – You gotta have a metabolism to live
absolutely
in New York, right? You gotta have a certain metabolism,
high energy,
right? But yeah. But then the question is there at the bottom of that, is there stress and tension, or are you basically
connected,
or are you basically chill,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I think coming from California and living in New York, it's like there's a, you know, you keep my metabolism's pretty high, but there's also like this. I still have like the California that core. I still have this California bottom.
That, you know, resonates, I mean, with me.
Yeah,
for
you know
sure
what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I think you meet people who like who can work in both places. There's people you meet in LA who could never hack
handle
New York.
Yeah.
And you meet people in New York who could never hack LA. They'd just be like lose their minds, right? But if you have that, then there's this kind of category of person who can play in both places and like feels comfortable in both places. And that's a good vibe.
I vibe with that too.
Yeah,
people in New York are so amazed how friendly the people out here are.
Yeah.
You say, wow, people in California are so cool. You know, you could talk to them. You don't know them. You can say hi to them. You would not say hi to somebody in New York if you don't know them.
Yeah.
How you do? Just walk right by you. Instantly make it, who the fuck are you?
What?
You hitting on me, motherfucker? You know, New York is weird. If you don't know them, don't say.
They don't have time.
Yeah, don't say anything.
People don't have time.
I think most people, if you came up and said, hey, they'd probably say, hi.
Yeah, listen. When
it
I was
you.
This what happened one day. I was came back to my old neighborhood. I was 14 at the time, right? And I was living with cuffs, so I had probably a year or two. So I have a whole different life reaction than back in Black Brownsville. So I'm in Brownsville, and some guy on the street where I'm with my friend, and he said, what's up? I said, hey, what's up, man? Because I'm used to being, now everybody knows me, I fight, and everybody says hi to me upstate New York. So I come to here, and this guy says hi to me. Hey, say, hey, how you doing? And my friend said, yo, Mike, you know him? I said, nah. So what you say hi to him for? I said, I don't know. I said, fuck that nigga. Don't say hi to that motherfucker. And that's just how it was.
Wow.
If you don't know him, don't talk to him.
And your friend was still in the Brooklyn mindset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of lifestyle it was.
Yeah.
Don't say hi to somebody you don't know.
Yeah, dude. I remember
this
that.
This guy might be trying to hit on you or something.
Yeah.
That's the mindset.
I mean, in L.A., you might try to say hi to somebody and they might be totally emotionally shut down. But, you know.
Dead.
They're still.
Dead in this. Like, dead, dead at the level of soul. Just completely dead-souled.
Yeah, but
like
at
soul,
least.
Like a zombie soul, you know? Like the soul of one of those zombie dragons
but you
in
have
Game
to,
of Thrones.
It's true.
Kind of thing,
yeah, totally
it's
two
true
different cultures.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's totally two different.
Totally different. But similar in certain aspects. I think there's a level of thinking happening in both cities.
Yeah.
That, you know, is very high level.
New York is this way.
Well it's funny.
LA
like
LA is this way.
Well, just on like, just even, like you think about on the, if you go, yeah, I grew up here and then I've lived in a bunch of places. I lived in Washington, D.C. and Chicago and London and Boston, a bunch of places. And then at one point, I went up and lived in San Francisco for about 4 years, like 1998 to 2002, right before I moved to New York. And what's cool is, and the thing that you're saying, I think that is true, if you think about these big, broad social change, you know, whether it's legalizing cannabis or gay marriage or the environmental movement or whatever, like big things that have changed the country. A lot of them start here. You know, it's like a lot of them in Northern California and to some extent in Southern California, where the progress takes root in California, and California is, you know, 10, 20 years ahead of the rest of the country. And then the sort of next, the East Coast, which everybody thinks of being as super liberal. Everybody thinks California is super liberal too. But it's – even though they're both liberal politically, the change often starts here. And then sort of gets adopted by other progressive minds outside of California. So it's like California is like the birthplace of a lot of
those
big changes.
I would say that 100%.
Yeah.
And then it's the Black Power movement.
Right.
California.
Yeah, totally. Mm.
Yeah.
You think about all the shit in the late 60s that came out of that Northern California scene, whether it was like the free speech movement, the Black Power movement, the environmental movement, computers, you know, and all the stuff around people taking control over their lives through technology, you know, the notion of personal technology and the ability to, like, you know, use these big computer systems
to come to this where we have this,
where it's individual, right? Yeah. That's like, that's a huge social change too, and a lot of that stuff took root up there. And then, you know, eventually, kind of like the thing starts on the West Coast and gets adopted then on the East Coast, and then eventually washes over the rest of the country when, you know, when it gets more broadly embraced. But that's why I think there's something in common between California and New York, even though they're totally different in the vibe of the place and a lot of the metabolism is different. It's still the openness to new ideas, you know, tends to be – you see that. That's the thing that holds L.A. and New York are kind of in common. You get those places that are willing to embrace change in a way and then kind of push the boundaries of what's considered conventional or acceptable. And, you know, still the case that cannabis isn't legal in New York State, you know, which is – you know, you think everybody says New York is like the most liberal place in the country.
Right.
But you know, they're still behind on some stuff like that. You know, we're going to get there, and it's not going to be – it's not very far off now, but it's not – it hasn't been at the forefront of that change.
What do you think about, in New York City, the stop and frisk situation?
They still have that now? Did they stop that?
Yeah, they stopped that. You know, it was
they stopped.
They stopped that. You know, de Blasio moved away from that. I think, you know, it was, you know, you think about the period.
It's very Gestapo-ish.
Yeah.
You know?
It was not, you know, you think about the three terms that Mike Bloomberg had as mayor were really good for the city in a lot of ways. And there were a lot of things that were. You know, the city got better in almost every way that you could measure. But there were a few things that were still fucked up that needed to change, and I think that was one of them for sure. Mm. You know, it takes time to change some stuff. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
for sure.
You know, that's of course a Giuliani thing. You know, from where it started was back before that, and you know, just it's a pretty good place now. You know,
it is.
New York's a pretty good place.
It definitely is. It's a mecca when I go there. I get to visit probably once a year.
And you said you grew up in Park Slope?
Yeah.
Born in Park Slope?
Yeah. Well, born at St. Vincent's in New York City and, you know, then grew up in Park Slope.
So you and Mike basically have like Brooklyn, have kind of like Brooklyn, Brooklyn DNA in common.
Yes,
that's why you guys are doing this podcast together.
That's how we came together.
I believe so. Yeah,
you guys have the 7-1 down and deep in your gut somewhere. Yes. You got the 7-1-8.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The 7-1-8,
big time, bro.
That's it. It's the funniest thing. When I lived in Brooklyn for 10 years, more than 10 years. And what happened in those 10 years from 2003 to about when I left in 2016. So I was there 13 years. Wow, fuck. A long time. I forgot it was that long. I might have been stoned for part of that time. It's possible. But what happened was Brooklyn became this big brand. You know, you think about when you grew up there, right? Like Brooklyn was – like Manhattan was the shit, and the outer boroughs were the outer boroughs, and but people thought Brooklyn was like less, right? And then Brooklyn got super trendy, right? So it's like that whole the brownstone Brooklyn thing that was, you know, the Cosby family made that as a television show made really famous, and then Williamsburg, where I lived for a long time, became like the capital of hipster Brooklyn. So you would go to like Amsterdam or Paris or wherever, you know, Copenhagen, and people talk about Brooklyn now. Like Brooklyn is like for a lot of people around the world, Brooklyn is cooler.
Very hip.
Is cooler in their minds than Manhattan is.
For sure.
New York Magazine at some point in the middle of that, they did a thing about how about Brooklyn being, you know, the new Manhattan, you know, and Manhattan's trying to catch up to Brooklyn because like if you were, you know, the combination of it's a, you know, more racially diverse and all that kind of artisanal shit going on.
That's
and
all great. But listen, all that stuff is great going on. I'm still apprehensive about living there.
Yeah, really?
My past experience make me apprehensive. I don't care how beautiful that place looks.
Right.
You know, just, whoa, be
so
careful.
So if I took you back to Park Slope and we walked you down the street
It looks like.
Right, but you're walking down the street with a bunch of people, strollers. You'd still be like, you'd still have the clenched up. You'd be like ready for a fight.
No, I'm just saying anything can happen.
Yeah.
People could just, in Brooklyn, they just ride by in cars, get out of cars. They don't do no drive-by, but they get out of cars and start trouble, New York people. Just anything. People see you, it's just weird. You know what I mean? I know Brooklyn for being violent.
Yeah.
You know, you're on Park Slope and you're not, and you, and you're not Italian, you're dead. You know, you're dead. If you're in Howard Beach, you're black, you're dead.
Yeah. It's hard to, I think it's hard to get over, like, when you have the formative experience of your life where you have a certain kind of, like, you grew up someplace. It kind of doesn't matter if the place changes a lot. You still, no. It's still.
I've seen them dead bodies on the streets.
Yeah.
You know, you never forget that.
Hmm. Yeah. It's
when
hard.
I go there, I say, wow, I remember he got shot here. I remember they threw that big boat off the roof, an refrigerator off the roof on the cop's car here. And, you know, wow, this place is beautiful. White people live here now. Holy shit. That's how I think. I said, holy shit. I even saw, like, are you white man? She said, yes, I am. I'm saying, she's talking shit and everything. So I'm saying, whoa. They own the neighborhood now. It's just a trip how it had changed like that.
Must have been fucking weird for you to do the Broadway show, right?
Hey, yeah. Because I was, when I was a kid, right down the street where I would snatch people's chains or snatch their pockets out their wallet, or people on the street would, after I did it, that next day I would come by and the people that owned the store would say, you little motherfuckers start throwing things at me or chasing me because they saw me snatch the chain the other day. And now I walk down the street, everybody's, Mr. Tyson, Mr. Tyson, gotta get your autograph, Mr. Tyson, Mr. Tyson, Mr. Tyson. And that's really freaked me out.
What a trip.
Yeah, it really freaks me out.
What a trip.
It's like, I mean, you can't escape your past, right?
No, I don't try to escape it.
No, I mean just in general, people. I don't mean you, yeah. But I mean just in general, yeah. Your past is your past. Like yeah. You have
it's those there.
Those associations when the stuff that your idea of what a place is like from when you grew up is so powerful. How it leaves those impressions. They're never going to go away. Like somewhere, no matter what it looks like, no matter how much it's changed, you still have the thing of like this is what it was like when I was coming up, right?
And that's, what was that movie when the old man had old, and the little kid had the old man? He said, "May I have more, sir, please?" What was the name of that play? You remember that play? He asked for more, but the guy was the kind of guy. He had all the little kids. They lived in London. He had all the little kids go out and steal and bring the money back to him.
It's a Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens, yeah.
But that was my life. Oliver Twist.
We had our parents. We had our parents' friends, and our job was to rob people. My parents, my mother would have a boyfriend or have a man. I don't know if it was a boyfriend. I never saw him before. Have a man come, have sex with a man. We'd rob him. We'd cut his pockets. Rob him. Then have an older guy come up here and throw him out or something like that. What you doing with my woman? It was just everything was a scam. Everything was about beating the system. My whole life was consistent about beating the system or the white man or whoever it was that owned this world, and we were fucking subservient people, but we had to come up some kind of way. I had no idea that I was just poor and I was uneducated. I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how I got put in this world. What was my crime?
Man. What do you think, John?
I think that your story is like one of the great American stories, is what I think. I mean, I watched on the way out here two movies that I'd seen before, but I watched them again just for the hell of it because I thought it'd be cool to watch them. I watched the Toback movie and then Spike's movie. And just thinking about you got a lot of life in front of you. You and I were born like 6 months apart, right? You were born 66,
yeah.
Right? So June?
June 30th.
So January 23rd, 66. So you're 6 months younger than me, yes. Basically, right? So you got a lot of life still ahead of you. I hope we're going to be around for a while longer. So who knows where the story goes. But just this part of it, you know, you think about where you came from, what you live, the good and the bad, right? Just the whole arc of it. It's just a great, you know, if you think about America in the second half of the 20th century and, you know, now into the 21st century, the story you lived from that description of your childhood through, you know, the rise, the fall. You've had a couple rises and a couple falls. It's a fucking great story. I mean, like, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly, but like as a story of overcoming adversity, of reaching the highest heights, you know, and then having to suffer various kind of challenges and setbacks and overcoming those and getting to where you are. It's like, the story is the ending has not been written. Like I said, you got a lot more to go. But if you were going to write like about a great, you know, you're thinking about what would be among the many great American novels that could be written. This is a great. It's a fantastic journey you're on. That's what I think. It's an incredible fucking tale. Is what it is.
It's interesting that you said it because life is I explain it like this. When I said like I know somebody that grandmother was a slave. I've known somebody who was old enough and his grandmother was a slave. So I'm saying he knew his grandmother. And he knew me. So this man knew a slave, and he knew me. Wow, the distance between the two, it seems so far away, but it's not.
Yeah, it was like, it was one of the things Chris Rock talked about. I remember a few years ago, that's cool. A couple years ago, Chris Rock did an interview somewhere that I saw where he talked about how his grandmother, I think his grandmother, but not his mom, I think, but I think it was his grandmother who in South Carolina, like within his lifetime, his grandmother used to have to go when she would get, when she would have to have dental work done. She would have to go to the veterinarian in South Carolina because, like, no dentist would see a black person. So if she had to get a tooth pulled or something, she'd have to go to the veterinarian to get the dog to get her tooth pulled, right?
Oh yeah.
And that was like, but that's like a thing where you're like, it's like Chris Rock, and it's like this was he did this thing. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I remember reading this interview, but just to your point about like he's like, you know, my grandmother used to have to go to the veterinarian to get a tooth pulled, right? That's like within my lifetime. That's how fucked up things
listen,
were.
Listen, no,
yeah.
This is interesting. This is very. This is what we. Do you know the scar? This has happened. This is a grandmother, but it left a scar on him.
Yeah. Right. Totally. Yes.
He don't even know this woman, probably.
Yeah.
But it left a scar on him.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how it is in all. I don't know. I know definitely black communities were scarred from the past. You know, most of our pain is pain from the past. You know, and we internalize them to the future. You know.
I mean, that's the other thing. I think if you've lived your life, you just got an incredible number of stories too. Like just, I'm a storyteller, right? So, you know, I think about just having lived, you know, the things that people are obsessed with in America, right? They're obsessed with money. They're obsessed with fame. They're obsessed with winning. They're obsessed with celebrity. They're obsessed with that's a lot of stuff that American culture is obsessed with, right? You at various times have been at the absolute pinnacle of all those things, right? The greatest winner in your thing that you competed in your sport, you know, made a shitload of money, lived at the highest level of glamour, celebrity, fame, fortune, media attention, tabloid culture, going to prison. Like, I mean, all the shit that we're all obsessed with at one time or another, you've been at the absolute top of the mountain. Or the you know, going to prison at the absolutely, you know, the depth of the valley, you know. And again, people are obsessed in this country with prison too, right? Like we have people watch fucking prison shit on television all day long. You just have lived this, like, you know, for all the categories of things people obsess about, you have had some experience with, and not just an experience with, but like the most extreme experiences with. And I just like, when I hear you tell the stories you tell, the memories you have, good and bad, I just think like it's kind of crazy that you've been at the center of so many of the different like things that people in this country spend hours and days and months like
that's
just obsessed with.
That's
right?
Interesting absolutely. Too that you say that because all these things you see, all these pinnacles of success, all these zenith and all this stuff, all I experienced, and then I experienced a toad and none of it meant anything. Right. I haven't seen nothing.
Right.
It's nothing. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I haven't been anywhere. I haven't made my first step yet. So when does it happen yet? When I die? Do I start living then? Now that's where my mind is. What happens when I die?
It's a good question. That's one I can't answer.
To this energy that I have, like the energy you have right now
Eben
in your mind. Yeah. Whatever it is.
Eben.
What happened?
Eben.
What happened?
I'm sorry.
What happened
Eben.
With that energy?
Don't let me
did the energy
that
die?
Okay. It's okay.
Huh? Does the energy die? Does this energy we have, it just go black out and die? Or does it, you know, does it travel somewhere into a bug, a butterfly, a rock, a tree? What do you think?
John, you know about the toad?
I don't have a clue. I know about the toad, and you know, I do. And it's a... I think all of the – this is another category.
Who are you, John?
Who am I?
Where you came from? What's your purpose, John?
Those are good questions. I got the toad right here in front of me, or at least a version of the toad.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it was funny. I was just literally on TV a couple days ago talking to this guy who wrote this book. Do you know this guy, Michael Pollan?
Yes.
You know who that is?
Yeah, I'm just finishing How to Change Your Mind.
Right. So Pollan is, you know, a famous writer, lives up in Northern California, and had written most of his career about food and particularly about vegetables. Like, has written – wrote this book called The Omnivore's Dilemma wrote
– great nutritional
– yeah.
Writing.
So the dude's like very – and he got interested in psychedelics – because of his interest in plants, like as a nutritionally and otherwise. But he's obsessed with plants, right? So, and he's written huge best-selling books. The Omnivore's Dilemma was a giant number one New York Times bestseller for a long time. So he wrote this book that you've read or are almost through.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry about the name thing.
It always takes
me two.
Dude, it's my cross to bear.
It takes me two, but it always takes me two times. We just met, so I'll never fuck it up again.
Thank you.
But he's written this book about the psychedelic movement now, like where it is now, not the 60s version, not Tune In, Turn On, Drop Out, not like the – and that right. There's like a lot of legitimacy to that too. But
he gives a little history of that, which I thought was helpful.
Cool. Yeah. But it's funny because his book is about the fact that to a large extent, about what's going on with the increasing acceptance in the medical community – of the therapeutic benefits of various kinds of psychoactive drugs. So it's like from MDMA, ecstasy, to organics like psilocybin and the toad and other like organic ibogaine, other stuff that people take that grow out of the ground. But all of that stuff, which was, you know, demonized for a really long time, and to some extent LSD still is, but all of that stuff, which was demonized by the culture for so long – now it's starting to change.
Yeah.
And it's starting to change because of a relatively small number of people who have fought this fight for years and years. A friend of mine, when I was I went to Harvard as a graduate student at the Kennedy School of Government.
I see you.
And
I
say that though not to brag, but just because I met a guy there in 1988 whose name was Rick Doblin.
Oh yeah, of course. Head of MAPS.
So Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. And Rick had started MAPS a couple years earlier when I met him in 88.
Mm.
And so I've known that guy now 30 years. I met Rick. And Rick in 1988 was talking about how MDMA, psilocybin, marijuana to a lesser extent, but he was mostly focused on the psychedelics, had these potentially huge therapeutic benefits for terminal cancer patients, for soldiers with PTSD, for all that stuff, right? And this was 1988, okay?
Wow.
In 1988, I thought in 1988 there was no way that weed would ever be legal. There was still a huge thing that you had to decide in 1988 if you went to get a job someplace, like, am I going to allow myself to be drug tested? That was like the fucking war on drugs.
Yeah, that
was
the thing back then. I don't want to know I got drug tests. No drug tests.
Right, but that was the big discussion, right? You had Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, all that shit was happening. Those, you know, that was a big cultural moment. So to have somebody in 1988 say to me, hey, you know what? Like, first of all, weed's definitely going to be legal in our lifetime. I'm like, I don't think that's true.
Way.
I remember he was sitting in his apartment. He's holding a bud this big. And I'm like, okay, I like that. Let's smoke that. I can smoke that whole bud. And you're not going to convince me that that's going to be legal in my lifetime. And now it's mostly there, right? But he also was talking about the psychedelic stuff. And he was like, this is my cause, right? I'm going to try to work within real legitimate government channels to get the FDA and the DEA and all of the appropriate authorities to reschedule some of these drugs so that we can start to do research on them to prove that they're medically beneficial and then to start actually using them with people who need them, right? In 1988, and I was like, Rick, I love you and I believe in this cause and I had done all those drugs and I love them all and I thought they were great and I could see, like, I'm not just from a recreational standpoint, I could see what he was talking about. I'm like, I can imagine that a cancer patient or someone
soldier,
with PTSD.
Yeah.
These could be powerful things that could alleviate people's pain and help them to heal and to achieve higher understanding and all that stuff. But I thought the guy was fucking nuts to think that that was ever going to be achievable on a timeline that would be meaningful to me and him. And Michael Pollan's written a best-selling book about how it's happening.
Yeah.
Like at the best medical schools, the best research institutions in the country are breaking through and saying, yeah, you know what? This shit's real. This is going to work. It is therapeutic. It is legit. The harms are minimal, if any, and we need to change the laws.
And it inspires you.
And it's inspiring, of course. And so the laws are changing and we're breaking through. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's like I've given up I always was hopeful about these achievements and this progress. But I was skeptical about it because I thought the culture would fight back. But I'm like, you know what? Like, the progress is happening on all these fronts so much faster than anybody ever thought it would happen. And there's still a long way to go. But now I'm like, you know, I think we're going to get there. And people who need these medicines are going to get them. And people who
who need them for – who aren't even as extreme as cancer patients or people with PTSD, people are going to – like we're – like the progress is happening. This is a place where there's a lot of fucked up stuff in our world, but on this front, you well, can think, see every day that things are getting better. They're absolutely. Getting better. So
– well, I think that the state of this country, of the world, the state of consciousness that we're in is calling these things out. You know, yep. That's why people are being drawn to these.
Need to realize that some things on this world that we can't explain.
Well, exactly. Have you guys? I don't know how much you guys have talked about this on the podcast, but what made you start to experiment in this area? I don't know how much you guys have. You guys might talk about this all the time. I don't know.
Psychedelics?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is interesting.
Have you guys spent time on this on this podcast a lot?
We talk about it a lot.
This is going to be very interesting. It might be
so it might be repetitive for some of the listeners, but I'm interested. I just want to know.
No, man, yeah.
I want to know how you got there.
Oh, listen. I'm an addict. I'm a bad addict, and I'm a drunk, and I'm a sex addict. Oh, I'm addicted to everything, okay? So I'm living my life, doing my cocaine, doing all my stuff, and one day I don't care. And so we're doing a pod, like you, and this guy's a doctor. Yeah. And he's talking about some kind of drug that's going to make me see God.
5-MeO-DMT.
And this, and it's going to like being in heaven, you're going to die. And I'm on cocaine right now. I said, really? Oh, is that so? And I said, where is it at? He said, I have it right here. I said, well, let me check it out. Let's check it. He said, well, we can't do it right here. I said, why not? Because I didn't understand that kind of drug that you had to situate, you had to position yourself. I didn't understand that drugs is what you take in the street. You just take the drug right here and let's continue talking. I thought we were going to do it, but it wasn't that. So he said, all right, wait. And so during our conversation, he's talking. I said, man, where's the shit? Are you ready? And he said, oh, no, wait. And so we go in Mexico somewhere. And he put some golden dust. It's like gold dust. He put gold dust in it and he said, and he lit it and he said, inhale. And once it came out, it was all cool. Once it came out, whoa. This is what I said. Oh, shit, I fucked up. These white motherfuckers killed me. I'm dead. Oh, shit. Fuck, why am I trying to prove I am dead? Oh, shit, I'm dead. And I woke up, I guess it was 10 minutes later, and man, I just was so afraid. I didn't know what happened.
What was the first thing? Well, what did you know what that was, the first thing you did?
The first thing when it hit me?
Yeah, what was the substance? What was the thing you were
smoking? It was the toad.
It was the toad, okay.
5-MeO-DMT.
Okay, and, okay.
I've seen Aztec pyramids. I see hieroglyphics. I'm seeing things. I'm seeing chambers of the past. I can't see myself. It's just energy. My body doesn't exist, and it's just noise. You can't even explain. I stopped breathing. I died. And I was telling the guy, I said, I'm not dead. I'm dead. I am dead. I'm dead. Right? I'm fucking dead. Keep it. You can be real with me. I can handle it. I'm dead, right? And I was so scared. Once I woke up, I said, where's my wife? Where's my family? Where's everybody at? And I said, do they know where I'm at? Do they know I'm here? And I was just, I've never experienced anything like that before. I actually died, and I didn't know what to do. It stripped me of my ego. I thought I was a tough guy. When it strips you of your ego, it's like ego killing.
Ego death.
Yeah, killing drug. And once it kills you, don't know, man, you feel so you don't even know what you're afraid of. You don't know what you think somebody's going to kill you, fuck you, rape you, murder. You don't know what's going to happen. And you just, fuck. You're happy it's over. But after it's over, you get that, them dolphins that feel like, what the fuck happened? And I'm just so happy to be up, and I'm fucking crying. I'm holding people. And that's the first time I did it, right?
Have you guys ever done a pod while you guys were all
Doing DMT?
I know.
Oh, my God.
It doesn't last that long when you do the DMT.
Yeah, help yourself there, John.
No, I figure the tray's there for a reason, right?
Course,
I mean,
brother.
I consider that kind of a...
I haven't done the toad. I've done DMT and psilocybin and LSD. And I think that, you know, anyone who tries these things, guys like Rick Doblin.
Yeah.
Had you tried psychedelics at that point?
Yeah.
You had?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the experience is...
I would say that by the time I got to graduate school, which was that, 1988. So I was in college in 1983, 1987. There were not that many substances that you could name that I had not tried by 1988.
There was probably some. Yeah. It was some. It would be on the list of stuff that there is to try versus stuff that I hadn't
tried.
You tried
a lot.
The list was over here was a lot longer than the list over here.
Hey, I get it, dude. I totally get
that. After I did the tour, I never wanted to do cocaine and another drink.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's something about these experiences that is so uplifting, connecting. You know, it dissolves the disconnection, the isolation, you know, in any way, even if you are alone.
Right.
You know?
But you've done, now you've done MDMA?
I haven't done MDMA.
All right, you gotta make some progress. We gotta help him.
I don't know. That's I'm like not really called to MDMA,
like
though.
Well, you don't have to be. Yeah, you don't have to be called. I just think you should.
That's my vibe.
You should broaden your experience.
Yeah,
it's a you got one life, man. One life,
dude.
As far as I know,
I've been really no. I think we're here a lot.
Yeah. Oh, you do. You're a reincarnation guy.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Okay.
You know.
I think that's legit.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I think it's an interesting thing about, like, if you believe, if you are, I've always thought about the notion of, like, people who believe in reincarnation versus people who don't, right? Like, how that changes your life.
Yeah.
Your life philosophy. If you think you're coming back.
Yeah.
You have a different approach to things than if you think you're only here once, right?
It's not that as much as.
Do you think that's our ego thinking that we're coming back saying that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the only way I can conduct my life is guided by the higher power that I've come to have a relationship throughout my life.
Right.
You know, and that's not, that's just whatever it is inside me that tells me when something feels right and good and when something feels off and wrong. You know, and
how do you feel? Everything we learned since we've been a child about the world has been a lie. How do you feel about that?
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
I don't know. You know, I'm fucking Adam and Eve, fucking Christmas and all that bullshit, and how this shit got with, you know, Martians came here and fairy tales did this, and my baby was born without a dick and cum, you know, all that stuff.
Well, some of those stories I'm familiar with, and some of them I'm not. But some of those stories, like the Santa Claus Christmas thing, I'm familiar with. The dickless baby thing, I don't know as much about. That's not what I know.
Somebody
about.
Being born without having. Well,
I understand. I'm just saying. I don't know, man. I think you know.
Someone would say the angels blessed them with and blessed these people.
Yeah.
John, so what is your take on life then, dude?
Oh, come
you
on,
think
man.
We're just here what kind of a fucking once?
What kind of a podcast is this? This is like a fucking, are you my priest? My shaman? Which one?
More like a what? Shaman.
Well, maybe.
Well, more like a shaman than a shaman. I don't know, man. This is not my area of expertise. What are we
no,
fucking
no, but you, your feelings about this.
My sense about my...
But
I,
this ties my, into your overall feelings about the state of the country.
Yes.
Trump as a president.
I think
it fucking,
is...
You know, abortion laws being put into place in 2019.
Yes.
All of this shit
is tied together.
How
do you feel about somebody
telling
a woman what to do with her body? Like, she's useless, that she doesn't know what to do with her body.
I feel
she's a fucking puppet.
I feel very strongly opposed to that posture, and I find it really troubling that there's anybody who thinks that they should be able to legislate control over over women's or anybody else's bodies. So I'm against that.
Who gives them the right to have even fucking authority over women?
I think
don't women have a fucking authority, a fucking council for their own fucking living? Because they're totally two different species.
There's a question a lot of women are asking, especially right now, and they feel like they're having a lot of their rights constrained or stripped away from them.
I'm not a liberal guy.
You're not.
No, and I really believe that, you know, women should have their people. They should have, be able to live their own right, and they should even have their own laws, because we'll violate them anytime we get a chance. That's our nature as men, to violate the weakest sex, even right. The kindest men.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, what's our question? What's the question on the table?
I don't know, John. As far as, here's my question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Why does it matter, why the fuck does it matter to stand up for what you feel is right if this life is trivial and you only get one shot at it? Why is that important?
Well, I'm not sure that I
we're going to this is like a, you know, not a political philosophy question, but a philosophy question. I claim no expertise to this, nor do I think anybody really could possibly give a shit what I have to think about it. But I will say that I think that to say that you only are here one go round and that there's no either reincarnation nor heaven or, you know, there's no afterlife. If you believe that you are here as a corporeal being, you're going to be here for however many years, and when you die, it's over. Your consciousness is done. You've finished. I don't think that's at all that the corollary to that is that life is trivial, or that I think, you know, you could argue the opposite, and that, you know, we are, you know, we have a sort of profound obligations to our fellow travelers on this planet for however long we're here, and that in fact the notion of life as a finite thing sort of increases the level of responsibility that you have to take that limited gift that you have and make the most of it. And that part of making the most of it involves responsibility to your kids, if you have them, and your grandkids, if they have them, you know, to your elders who bring you up, that you have a you're more, you know, this is, if you only got one shot at it, you've got to get it right. And I think, you know, the fact that we as a species, I don't have children, so I speak as someone as an observer of it, but like that we have, that there are lots of people out there who have, you know, descendants, right? And that our obligation in our finite time here is to try to make sure the world is as good as it could be for them going forward. That, like, so that I'm not sure that I think you can feel,
hey, you're right on.
I think you can feel a profound sense of social and political responsibility. Regardless of what your view is about these things, whether you think that there, whether you're an atheist or whether you're a Christian or whether you're a Jew, whether you think there's an afterlife, whether you don't, I think all of those things still push you towards having a sense of responsibility, a collective responsibility to try to make the place that you are for you and your descendants and the species and its descendants, to make that place as habitable and sustainable and just as possible. So that's, I don't know, that's not exactly a potted worldview for me, but that's, I think that's the answer. I think that's the answer to the question of why you should give a shit if we're only here for one life.
I don't think we know anything. That's what I think.
That, I agree with that.
I think we don't know anything. I was told if you take a guy that lived to be 100 years old and he partied all his life for 100 years, and you take a guy that discovered the world for 100 years, and that's all he did for 100 years, at the end of the day, they both would know nothing about the world. This world, you know, is
it's unknowable.
It's inconceivable.
It's inconceivable.
You know what it looks when you look at us with a camera inside the atmosphere, and you see the other planets. It's almost like we're in a body. We're in some large body, and we're fucking probably a cancer or something in this body.
Maybe. We're just bacteria.
Yes.
Because
sorry to give you the impression that
I know this is like we're like, man.
No, John, I just you're the
we
man.
We are bacteria. Dude. No, we are back. We are some nasty motherfuckers if we didn't get those shots.
Yeah.
If we didn't get those shots, because right now we go to those Jawas, those guys that's in India on the island that's never seen men for like 60,000 years. And if we go right there, if they don't kill us with the spears, we're going to kill them in 2 days or 2 weeks because we're fucking filthy. Yeah. And we have shots. We have shots and we're going to still kill them.
Yeah.
It's pollution. Yeah.
So what's like – you guys don't – like when you do this podcast, I looked at the many guests who've been on it, and it's an awesome achievement. You guys have got this thing going. There's some great conversations that have happened here. But you haven't had a lot of people in here who've like – you guys don't talk a lot of politics in here, right?
No.
It's not like a thing you do. So, like, I'm curious, like, what's your, you know,
but I'm
Let's
do it.
Most people in the country right now, wherever they stand on the spectrum, feel like, have a very strong reaction to the President of the United States. Like, a lot of people hate him. A lot of people love him. He's got, you know, but it's very polarizing. And there's a sense for a lot of people right now, the stakes are really high, right? That, like, somehow this presidency is a little different. You go to your thing about, like, you know, how many chances do you get? Like, why on some level you could, you know, you say, well, you know, the president can change every 4 years. Why do we give a shit about any one of them? You know, there've been a lot. There'll be a lot more. You know, anything's, you know, remediable down the line. And yet for a lot of people right now, they feel like Trump is different. It's not like they don't look at Trump and say, well, here's a president who's kind of, he's here transiently. He'll maybe do some damage. Maybe he'll be good depending on your point of view, but eventually he's going to go. More people right now feel like it's a fucking 4-alarm fire. It's a state of emergency. Like the country's at stake. That the gravity of all this stuff, the Trump, again, whether you love him or hate him, either poses a unique capacity to make America great again, Or you think, like most liberals, and I would say a larger number of people, just statistically, it's true that there are more people who don't like Trump than like him, you know, who are like, this guy's a threat to American democracy.
Yeah.
He could fuck the whole country up and we can never recover.
Yeah.
So that's how people feel right now out in the world. So I'm curious, like, you know, what do you guys think about that? Do you guys think this is – do you give a shit about Trump?
I think American people panic too easy. They're quick to panic before they want to dissect the problem. Yeah. Oh, shit, they're coming. Oh, shit, the niggas are coming. Oh, God, this. Oh, God, this. And we panic too much without analyzing the situation.
Yeah.
And that's what I believe in. And I believe Trump brings out of a lot of fears of us because a lot of people with that mentality believe whatever he says is true. Oh, shit, the Mexicans are coming to get us. We need the wall.
Right.
You know, it's not because, you know, some people could look at Trump and say, this guy's a fucking idiot or something. And then some guys can look at him and say, he's right. He knows what he's talking about.
Right.
You know, but the deal is that it's about you as a human being. The majority of the people work like this, because I was one of them fucking poor slobs. We have no information. So only our information is just the television, which is lies. And after the television tells us what happened, we go in the neighborhood and we explain what the television told us, and this is right. What's going to happen.
Yeah.
Now, is that just...
propaganda?
Not only propaganda, but if that's just such an antiquated way of getting information and believing information, it's a whoa, you know?
Yeah.
It's the people, it's our minds that are molded. We've been molded for hundreds of years, thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. And then we've been changing. You know, we go from slavery, we go to serfism, then we go to communism, and then we try to go to a capitalism, and then... capitalism poison everything. It takes communism, and now we're going to start selling things in communism. We'll sell pictures of Mao in communism. That we'll still be communist, but that won't be bad. We'll live like capitalists, and that's just what the world is going through. There won't be no more. On communist is only a name now. There's no actual communist that's really happening in the world. You know, that's right. Just what's really happening. Not in Laos, not in Cambodia, not in none of those
places. Russia.
No, what are you?
What's Russia?
Russia is the most capitalist country in the world, probably.
But how is it run with the people? How is the economy?
The economy is magnificent. But listen, they need to.
I don't want to get there yet. Hold on. I want to answer John's question from my perspective.
Please.
I think the title of your show, The Circus.
Yeah.
Is a perfect explanation of
that. I was just explaining the circus.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I said. What I mean.
I mean,
about.
So
I was just explaining the circus.
You know, to me, it's
so for
John,
you,
it's
so
just
for,
a circus to me, man.
I
don't have a lot of faith in it, and I'm very skeptical of my government.
Well, it's funny. Know? I think that there's a lot, like in that is like a lot of like you're not alone. You know, there's like millions of people like you. Like that's a more common, you know, I live in this world where we all take politics really seriously. And I think I'll argue to the day I die that you should, because it has a huge effect on millions and millions of people. But we, you know, for the people who like follow this stuff day in and day out, they have very, you know, various opinions about things, right? And various opinions about people and assessments and what policies they favor, what personalities they like or don't, what they think is politically effective. In the end, though, they all feel like there's a caring about it that much, like knowing that much at a detailed level and having those views is sort of like conditioned on the notion that you think that it's a legit enterprise, right? That these are the legitimacy of the whole thing, of the whole game is inbuilt in that way of looking at it. But what I think is true is that if you go around and talk to a lot of people just in the country, they don't their presumption isn't that. Their presumption is that it's all a fucking scam.
Yeah.
And that like this the system, you know, these are part of the reasons why Trump was powerful.
Right.
Because like him talking, you know, you talk about the system, you know, Bernie Sanders and Trump are powerful in a lot of ways in a similar way, at least they were in 16, because they were like the system is rigged. Now, Trump was full of shit about most of it.
Yeah.
But as a thing that people heard over and over again, which was, you know, the system is rigged. Everybody's kind of trying to fuck you over. And this whole thing in Washington is so fucking dysfunctional and so corrupt and such a fucking bunch of bullshit that what I'm going to do is I want to blow the whole fucking thing up.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people in 2016 who voted for Trump, it was like – and for Sanders in different ways. Obviously, totally different guys.
Absolutely.
But that thing
– I totally agree with
that. That visceral thing for a lot of people was, I know Trump's a clown. I know he's a fucking liar. I know he's not really a billionaire. Possibly. I know all that stuff. There are a lot of voters who felt this way. I know all the things that are fucked up about him. And even I know he says this racist shit about Mexicans across the border. I know all that stuff. But you know what? Like, if I vote for the other person, the same shit's going to happen. It's just going to be more of the same shit. And the last, like, 30 years has just not helped me very much.
Yeah.
It's not really working out really well. So I'm willing to accept – again, I'm speaking here as a lot of people who voted for Trump, I think. We're part of, like – I know all the problems and I know all the risks. I get that he's all those fucked up things. But the only – but I'm – at least – he's going to change something. He's going to blow the whole thing up. He'll blow it up and we'll see what happens.
But imagine this, guys. Imagine you're a fucking black person and no matter who I vote for, I'm still going to get killed by the fucking cops.
And another perfect example of the thing. So I think for a lot of people, there's just an element of like their frustration with the whole process and their sense that it's all not on the level, that it's like it's a scam in some way and that – that's why people – why so many people are pissed and disenfranchised and and alienated from the whole thing. And it's how things like Donald Trump can happen is when there's a lot of people who are looking at the whole thing just going like,
of course,
this is bullshit.
Yeah.
So let's blow it up. So all I'm saying is I think that is – as you think about what's going to happen, people are not less pissed off than they were 4 years ago.
Yeah.
People are not less disenfranchised. People are more pissed off now than they were 4 years ago. All of the stuff that was out there, frustration, the anger, the distrust of the system, all the other fucking viscerally terrible negative things that are around in America, all of the bad shit is not better. It's just as volatile and fired up as it was then. So – this makes it very hard. This is not going to be a normal election, you know, and Trump makes certain that it's not going to be a normal election because he doesn't give a shit about any of the rules. He'll do whatever the fuck he wants. So I just predict chaos. I guarantee you that anybody who's making like certain predictions about what it's going to look like as this race unfolds.
Yeah.
Anybody who makes really certain predictions about that is out of their fucking mind. Yeah. Out of their mind.
Hey.
Yeah.
What do you know about your family? What are you, Italian, Greek?
That's a very good question, but it has nothing to do with Donald Trump. But that's probably for the best. I'm an adopted child, so I know everything about my adoptive family, but I know nothing about my genetic heritage. So
you know, this is interesting you say that. I always say to certain people and to myself, because I did a research on something, I found something out, and it really freaked me out.
Yeah.
So I did a research on this guy, and his name was Alexander Dumas from, like, the French Revolution and stuff back then.
Yeah.
And he's a mulatto. He's a black guy, right? His parents from Haiti, and he was in Napoleon. Even before Napoleon, he was in other guys, too. The 16th, Louis XVI, he was in his army as well. So, but he got in Napoleon's army when Napoleon got army. And so I did research on him and stuff and his sons and everything. And then when I'm doing research, he used to always go to war when the French Revolution, he had the sword. And so I'm following his ancestry, right? I'm so awesome at that, right? So I'm and then I realized that in 48, probably in the 32, his family, they changed their name from Dumas, he married some Jewish man, to Oppenheimer. They become fencers. He's a swordsman in the war. They become fencers. They win Olympics. They're in the Olympics and stuff. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Incredible, right?
Yeah.
But this is what I'm saying. This is only 200 years. He goes from black. Now he's a white Jewish guy.
Wow.
So I wonder sometimes, who was my first bloodline? Male. Who was the first one? Where did he come from? Was he black? Who was he?
You learn more about your family as you did, you know, various things over time, right? You, for a long time, you didn't know very much.
No, I didn't know shit.
And then you found, like, you, for for some of the stuff you've done in media, you kind of, like, looked at it, right?
Me and among my half-brothers did a lot of research.
Yeah. And so what's like, what of all the stuff that you learned about your family, what's like, what was the stuff that blew your mind most?
Education, musically inclined. I'm not educated and I'm not musically inclined, but that was forced in that bloodline.
Right.
And so most of these guys are teachers, musicians and stuff like that. My son loves music. It's from genetics.
Right.
It's awesome, my mother was a teacher. It's just what it was. That's what they did. That was important in their life during the Reconstruction. Education was important. Entertainment was important to them. You know what I mean? My brother was the first guy to integrated football in his school in North Carolina. Mm. Football. He was a great football player in high school.
That's awesome. That's great to learn all of that.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, that's like.
But what I saw about my parents, my family liked the party. They always went out. They like dressing up, looking nice. Always, you know, they're very Southern, so they got their money on their birthday. They tape the money on their clothes for their birthday. So you see money so they're celebrating somebody's birthday.
That's cool.
Very country people, very country.
Well, Mike, you're not formally educated, but you're an educated man.
That's probably my insecurity for not being formally educated. I wanted to just know everything. And everything I know, I realize it's a lie, but if you know it, just knowing a lie is knowing something. You know, just knowing these lies is make you somebody. Just because they're lies, everybody knows there's lies, but if you know them, you're cool. I know nothing but a bunch of lies, but people think I'm smart. How am I smart? Because I know lies. Right? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
I understand that.
So where are we? Where are we? Where do you want to go?
Know,
what do you want to talk about, man?
Anything.
Wait. I had a question before.
What about the lady? What's her name again?
Which lady? This is going to be a close election. You know? Trump could easily get beat, and Trump could easily still win. And there's a lot of ways. It could go either way. You look at what happened last time. You look at all the stuff we talked about before about what's going to happen this time. I think there's, you know, you could easily imagine a series of things unfolding where Trump is able to win because for a variety of causes. And there's just so much anti-Trump feeling out there.
Why is it important to you,
Democrats.
John, who's president?
Because I think the person who's president is, in the end, exerts not sole power, but an awful lot of power over a whole bunch of stuff that affects pretty much everybody in the country. You know, like there's, you know, federal policy of one kind or another. There's nobody in the planet who's not affected either adversely or beneficially by a bunch of federal policies.
That's
so I think
true. That's true. But listen, if us as people in America was collectively caring and loving for each other and cared for each other and saw people in trouble and went in and got involved with them and helped them get out of trouble,
yes,
we wouldn't care who was president because we could drive off of each other.
I think there's a – I think the government –
that's not a real world.
I think the government broadly defined is going to – in a country of 350 million people, the government is going to play a big role in everybody's life, whether it's – some people has bigger role, some people has a smaller role. But there's – once you recognize that there's people who need – healthcare, they need education, they need a bunch of really basic things. No matter what your vision of government is, maybe there's a world in a fantasy where everybody just collectively bands together and provides everything for each other. That's not been the history of any place I've ever heard of, any place on planet Earth ever. So I'm all for people caring about each other more, for community-based stuff, for volunteerism, for
people.
We're
not made for that stuff, though. I would be honest. We're not made for that stuff.
We have not. Like I said, the history of the country is filled with violence, meanness, greed, nastiness, as well as altruism and optimism and progress. They always
exist
in balance.
It's easy for us to fight than it is for us to be friendly, though.
Well, we have done both, and it's a seesaw back and forth, and they both exist in the country at the same time. There's a lot of division, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of hatred, there's a lot of racism, there's a lot of oppression, and there's also a bunch of really great stuff that goes on for a lot of people who are it's both, right? And so given that it's both, and given the country's so big and so complicated, the government is going to matter no matter what. And if the government matters,
so if the world
the president doesn't get to control everything, and he in fact has a lot of constraints on his power. If the president has enough power, even with all the constraints on him, to be able to institute a border policy in which undocumented immigrant children can be torn away from their torn away from their parents and put in cages. Okay, so I think a different president wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And this president did that. So that's why, you want to pick one example why it matters who's president? That's why it matters who's president. Because that guy gets to decide some stuff that has a pretty fucking major effect on some lives in a very direct way.
I mean, this is my worst
case. And a lot of
case.
Other reasons.
Listen, we as Americans and stuff are always willing to give some kids over in Africa, give them Malaysia a bunch of stuff, give people in Somalia. We're always willing to give them, but we're not taking care of our minorities over here. We're not taking care of our poor over here.
Mike makes a great point. Not about the foreign aid part.
What the hell we care about these Africans, the Malaysians, what we care about these other countries. We don't give a fuck about blacks here. Why do we care about blacks in Africa?
I do not think we have to in a world that's not.
I don't know.
I think we can care about both, Mike. Right? Can we care about both? We can care about. We can care about both, right?
We should care about both.
We should care about both. But why don't we?
Well,
why don't we?
That's a deep question. I don't know the answer to that question. But I think that, you know,
why are we going to keep getting killed from cops to the end of the fucking world? My great grandkids are going to see cops kill black people.
Can I tell you my theory on that, Mike?
I don't disagree with that.
Mike, you know, just like The black community has its scars.
Yeah.
Of the past that lived through.
Mike's brought it up a couple times today.
So rightly do so. White European descent Americans. Because this country or that group of people, for the most part, has failed to acknowledge the horrors of many past actions.
Yeah, sure.
That this country is built on. And so refusing responsibility over any of that gives us this psychological, I don't know, prison
but that we've built around ourselves. When does this stop? Is it going to last for another 2,000, what, 100,000, a million years? Are we going to continue to go? Are we going to ever learn?
Maybe when both sides can reconcile the past. I don't know if that's something that's possible.
You know what the answer is? 350 million toads. Like, you know, you get the toad.
350 million toads.
Widely distributed toads and the practice of licking them could change a lot.
But
in terms of the outlook.
Why are people so predictable? Why are people only certain ways and we know they're that way and they can't be any other way?
But look, I agree. I'll tell you what you said a second ago that I agree with is, you know, the reality is that, like, there's a lot of people who, you know, no doubt, like, look, you know, you start talking about historical disadvantage, historical oppression, historical rape and pillage and plunder. The African-American community are way ahead of everybody in terms of having been fucked over by America for a long time. They're not doubt about that. But your yes. point, though, there's another point, which is, you know, I think
it's
at least part of
side.
Your point, probably part of your point is that there's definitely a flip side, but there's also, you know, you can, there's disadvantage and,
you know, you
and
have to look
and,
at it like this. See, I understand what you're saying, but like, and I understand what you're saying about your white, listen, white, say you're a white immigrant and you come here, you're an Irish guy. If you make it, you can get some slaves, and then you made it in society.
I think there's no doubt that
there's no more pain.
There's no doubt that as a class, that African Americans are like.
But
why doesn't it stop?
How
are more
it
fucked
never
up?
Stops?
Wow, dude, man.
Why does it never stop?
Mike keeps asking me these existential questions about, like, you know, like that I don't have the answer.
No, you have the answer.
Why is it never? I don't have the answer, man. I don't know.
Theory.
Why does every human that's ever lived on planet Earth have like some kernel of hatred in his heart or her heart? Like, you know. Hatred as far as I know in the history of humankind, you know, there have been, you know, people, there's been hate, you know, it's what it is. You know, I don't know why that is. I don't know. I mean, that's a different level question, but the reality is that, you know, the division, oppression, anger, violence, crime, you know, sexism, racism, that stuff has characterized every society to one degree or another, pretty much has ever been on planet Earth. I don't know why it is, but it's a persistent feature.
Why we can't learn from our past and make a different life for our future?
Well, I think a lot of people try. A lot of people are trying to do that, and some people less and some people more. But, like, I think there's a, you know, it's a struggle, right? So it's the constant struggle. It's not going to change anytime soon.
So what do you think about – so your job, your show, The Circus, right?
Yeah.
So what is your basic synopsis of The Circus?
Well, you know, we basically do a show that's on Showtime that's a weekly real-time documentary about politics. So, you know, we started out in 2016 as a campaign show. We were covering the presidential campaign on a weekly basis. So we would go out every week at the beginning of the week and we'd shoot with a bunch of crews and shoot all week long. Our show's not like – we don't do like archival, historical. We're like in the moment of that week. So what we shoot from Monday to Saturday is what goes into the episode that you see on Sunday. So it's not live television. We're obviously – we've got four or five often crews out shooting 8 hours a day. And we're sort of making – as we go through the week – we start out with an idea of what the episode is going to look like, but as events occur, we adapt to the world. So we're trying to both do sort of like tell you what happened last week in politics that matters and also kind of tell you a story. So it's not just like a news digest of like here's a list of important things. It's like we're out trying to sort of stitch together a little mini documentary, but one that's alive to the world of breaking news and like what's happening in the world. So if Donald Trump does something on Thursday that changes the arc of our narrative, we got to pivot and kind of reorient the show. I don't really think anybody's ever tried to do anything like it before. It's a really, really hard show to make and also a really rewarding show to work on. And it's different. It looks different
then
is it international or just locally?
We're focused on American politics. We can only do that. I think it'd be cool to do the circus in a bunch of different other countries.
Like, and England's a trip.
Ever since the Brexit thing started, I thought, you know, if I were in London, I'd be trying to make the circus a British Brexit focused circus would be a great thing to do.
What do you think about that? The Brexit.
Yeah. I think it's a big fucking mistake. There was a sizable number of people, you know, the project of integrating the various countries of Europe into a single structure was like a decades long project that has been complicated, and some countries have embraced it more than others. Britain's always been a little bit on the edge of it. They feel like they're part of Europe but kind of apart from Europe. And right. So the forces, you know, when they took it to the country and said, do you want to stay in the European Union or do you want to exit, meaning Brexit, right? It was a big deal and a very close vote, and a lot of people just assumed that the stay campaign, staying in Europe, would win. And then there was a surprise thing that happened in the same year that Donald Trump got elected. There was a loud populist nativist argument, which was basically in the country saying, if we're part of Europe, Europe exerts too much control over us. We lose autonomy. They're trying to impose European values on us, and we want to be. We're Britain.
Britain.
We got to be alone. We can go it alone, right? And the economics of it are terrible for Britain, and they're going to suffer enormously. And everybody who – I think what happened in the campaign was the people who thought that staying in Europe was the right thing to do, which economically for the country's well-being, it was the right thing to do. And the project of European integration had largely worked for Britain. But the people who thought that – like sort of got lazy about making the argument. They were like, well, we're obviously going to win.
Yeah. Britain has so many billionaires that live there.
And that is true. And a lot of them are not from Britain. A lot of them from Russia and other places. Yeah. Mm. So I think that loud Trumpy like isolationist argument was able to win partly because the other side kind of got lazy and complacent about making it. And now it's just been a fucking mess. Mm. Because as soon as the vote happened, there was like immediately people said, did we really just do that? Like, really? Like, what the fuck? I mean, there was literally for about a week in Britain, there was a thing of everyone going,
hey, what about the wealth gap?
Wait a minute. What the fuck? Huh. What the fuck did we just do? No, that wasn't supposed to happen. This was supposed to
really fucked up, man.
So then they've spent now the last basically 2 years, like more than 2 years now, trying to like figure out like, okay, like how do we do this in a way that won't destroy the fucking country?
Right.
Like, you know, like, wait a second. Okay. We voted to do it and the vote was legit. But if we do it, the country's gonna be fucked. So they've spent basically 2.5 years unsuccessfully trying to figure out a way to be like, okay, we're gonna honor the will of the voters and we're gonna exit, but we're still gonna like be enough part of Europe that the economy and the financial markets aren't gonna collapse. And they have not been able to figure that shit out. That's the bottom line. Britain right now is more fucked up than America. We've lost a prime minister who couldn't figure it out. No one knows.
The world is moving in a speed that we just. It's inconceivable.
It is correct. It is totally correct.
Absolutely,
it is the thing. The main thing that has characterized my career covering politics since 1990, so 29 years, the main thing has been an increase in chaos, unpredictability, black swan events, shit people nobody said would never happen, happening. And big, like, shocks to the system that made the pool of people who are interested in politics bigger. Like, and the polarization thing of people being definitively on one team or the other. Like, when we were all growing up, people basically looked at politics. It was like, oh, we have a presidential election every 4 years. I'm going to pay attention to that really for the last 2 months of the election. From, like, Labor Day to Election Day, I'll pay attention every 4 years. It was sort of like the way a lot of people thought about Wall Street, right, where it's like – you know, big, huge part of the American economy that I only pay attention when there's a crash or a giant boom, right? And people basically were – many people were of the mind – whether you'd say, well, are you a Democrat or a Republican? They'd say, I'm a Democrat. But they voted for Republicans sometimes if they liked them, or they were
right.
– ticket splitting happened all the time.
Yeah.
Over the last 30 years, like if you think about the Clinton election, then the recount in 2000, the Iraq war – Barack Obama gets elected. Donald Trump gets elected. Every single one of those things was sort of a what the fuck moment. And
the church of like who cares about politics just got bigger, and it became more and more part of.
We need a woman president now.
That's that. Many people would agree with that, and I'm certainly one of them.
Absolutely,
I think a woman president would be a great thing, and it's way too long. It's way too long for that. But that thing of more and more people being interested in politics because it's gotten crazier.
She can't be that, like that lady in England, May. She can't be like her.
Theresa May.
That's bad shit.
Well, she did not do a great job dealing with the Brexit thing. But that thing of like getting more people caring because more shocking shit has happened and has been more part of the popular culture, that's one big thing. And then the fact of nobody now saying, I'm a Democrat, but I vote for a Republican. Everybody's like, I'm on team blue. I'm on team red.
Right.
And back in the old days, like when people like cared a lot about like for like inter – like there's a, you know, a time when we were first growing up. Like people didn't want their kids to get married outside their faith, right? It's like, you know, you don't want to marry a Catholic boy. You don't want to marry a Jewish girl. You got to stay within the faith or within the race. Don't marry a black person or you can't marry a white person. Now it's like, you know, we got interracial marriage, a lot of it, a lot of interfaith marriage. But what you now hear is this thing where it's like you – what the thing that people care about is don't let your daughter marry a Republican.
Yeah.
Or don't let your son marry a Democrat. Like that's the thing that people now are like, oh, no, yeah. no. I don't really care who my daughter marries, but if she marries a fucking Republican –
Hello. Did you see Arnold Schwarzenegger get drop kicked?
Yes.
Drop kicked where?
Oh, show it, dude.
Holy
where?
Fuck.
Show, man. That's a dirty motherfucker did this, man.
Dude, he got fucking drop kicked.
Drop kicks?
That's how I don't hang out in fucking Africa, man. That's
so by drop kicks, you mean like a physical thing that happened to him?
Mil Mascarius used to do the motherfucker.
This is not like a...
Look at the bullet coming out this guy.
That's crazy. Crazy. We were watching that yesterday.
Bullet coming out this guy.
Arnold Schwarzenegger kick video.
Look at this.
Oh,
dude.
The kick
look
video.
Look at all this is bullshit. Look at this. Oh, he should shoot. Oh, they got to put this guy in jail, man. Look at this. Oh, look at this, man. This is not cool, though. This is not cool. Look how she's jumping rope. She's jumping her ass off.
Killing it.
Look at that girl.
Arnold looks great.
He does?
Looks great.
Oh, not now. Wait till you see it in a few minutes. Oh, you saw that girl jump rope? That's incredible. Oh, shit.
Oh!
Look at that.
Oh, they got that motherfucker. Oh, they got him. They got that motherfucker. What kind of bullshit was that?
So that guy ran up and kicked Arnold Schwarzenegger in the back of the head?
Oh, you know, he's in South Africa. You know, they beating his black ass.
But is that what happened?
Jail. Oh, they're beating his motherfucker.
Is that what happened?
Yes. Well, we appreciate you coming out,
Mike's
brother.
Mike, you're a big YouTube fan, right?
Oh,
yes.
You love YouTube,
yeah,
right?
I love it all night. I'm going to leave here and go home and watch it till I fall asleep at like 4 in the morning.
Right, just YouTubes.
Yeah.
Like dozens of video after video.
Everything. Anything.
I heard some
prison YouTube, everything.
I heard some statistic recently that you're like, of all the people who've ever been watched on YouTube, like in the history of YouTube, that you're you have a pretty high ranking.
He's like number 3.
You.
On what?
On YouTube clips.
I don't know about what are you talking about.
You
most viewed person.
Yeah, like the you know, YouTube, right? We were just talking about YouTube clips, right? So I believe it's the case that because there's so many clips of you out there in the world that among all the people who played video clips on YouTube ever in history, like you're pretty close to the top of the list of the most viewed clips because all your knockout clips are like have been circulating for years and years and years.
I'm a pretty dark person.
You're a pretty.
I'm a pretty dark person.
Who is the most?
You don't seem like a dark person to me, man.
Oh, I got some shady parts.
Well,
I got some shade on me, dude.
That I do not at all. I would not contest
the shade, but you know,
I would not quibble with that assessment sure.
But the toad took a lot of stuff away. The toad showed me the light, man. I'm telling you. Didn't care about anybody. Didn't give a fuck. Had girls, had this, had everything on the world, doing drugs, didn't give a fuck about nobody, all this shit, and I did the toad, and I never saw those people again in my life. Never had no more, never did anything, never, it all was over.
You're trying to get a stat here.
Yeah, I'm trying
can't
to get some
it?
Stats.
You can't get a stat.
This is bullshit.
It's fucking bullshit. It's the worst, man.
Fuck this.
You know, the internet just really...
Fuck this.
I don't understand
it's fucking great, but it's also just a bunch of... It's really giant, huge fucking hairball. A hairball bullshit.
Right?
You know, a bullshit burger.
Fuck.
You get on there, you try to...
What kind of food do you eat?
I just want to have, like, you just want to... You're like, I got a really simple question. I just want the answer to this question. I just want to play it, and it's like... And you can't get the answer you want. A simple thing like
John.
You know, yeah.
What kind of food do you eat?
Man, I like food of all kinds, Mike.
What kind of food do you eat, John?
I do, man. I have like a very, very broad palate, so I eat a lot of food. Like, what do you mean? Like, am I a vegetarian? I'm not.
No,
I'm a carnivore.
Yeah.
I enjoy food of very lowbrow food and highbrow food.
You eat a lot of beef and a lot of meat?
I love beef, man. I love a good steak. You?
No.
No. Mm-mm. You went vegan a while ago, right?
Yeah, I'm vegan now, but I can't. You know what? When I eat a lot of meat, it hurts when I fucking shit. I can't shit when I eat a lot of meat. I can't fucking shit.
You know what I think the solution to that is?
What?
Don't eat meat.
I exactly agree.
There you go. Done.
I'm not Michael Pollan, but I know enough about nutrition.
You know, it's if so I can't fancy. Fuck shit, but if I can't shit, fuck. Fuck.
If I can't fuck shit. If I can't shit, fuck. It's so true.
Man, that is like that
words to live
I
by.
I swear, like that, we're done.
We're done.
This podcast is over. That's like
drop the mic.
Hey,
John. Seriously?
You don't get anything better than you don't get a better kicker than that. Yeah. That's like that's the end.
Let's wrap
actually,
this up.
Actually, it's probably the only thing for the podcast that she actually said.
Thank you so much, man.
Really, thank you.
Thank you, dude. That was really a lot of
this
fun.
This is like a good... This is a, yes, a good...
You got a good thing going good here, man.
We love going to work.
Mike, great episode,
man,
brother.
One of the best, man.
John, thank you if so much. Where can people find you?
Yeah, information, man.
Let people know.
If I can't fuck shit, but if I can't shit, fuck.
So true. Man,
it's fucking the best. You know, check out Circus on Showtime. We'll be back in the fall. I'm also on MSNBC a fair amount, and, you know... Like, just, you know, pay attention.
Yeah.
At Jay Heil on Twitter. At Jay Heil on Insta. At Jay Heilman on Instagram. J-H-E-I-L-E-M-A-N-N. You know, follow me on social. I do some shit there. Not like not like these guys do. Monsters of social media.
Oh, no way.
Monsters of social media.
We just want to know what life's about.
We just want to put the positivity out there,
man. We want to know people's perspective on life. Because, you know, a lot of people walk around here all day and they're living life. And then all of a sudden they say, wow, it's almost over. I'm going to die soon. What the fuck is going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like your. I like this next chapter in your life, man.
Thank
I like
you.
It.
Good, right?
I like it. I like it. It's good. I like it on a variety of levels. I like the self discovery piece. I like the toad piece. I like the business piece of it. It's like a good like. You're heading into an excellent new chapter. It feels like.
Hey, listen. I never thought this would ever happen in my life. I always said, "Oh, this shit, I'm gonna die soon. This is gonna be over, man. I'm gonna catch AIDS, or so I'm gonna get fucking shot by this guy by fucking his wife or something crazy like that." And everything just came to no, really, guys.
Nobody's making funny, man.
Dude, I laugh because it's just so amazing to hear you be so honest about it.
Yeah, it's
you
know,
and you
crazy.
Put it so matter of factly. And so beautifully that it's just, it causes me inspiration inside.
No, but you know what? Listen, I didn't know how to live.
Yeah.
Like, I was champ. I had money. I had all these, everything at my beck and call. I didn't know how to live. I didn't know what to fucking do.
Like I said, it's one of the great American stories. I'm not kidding.
It's like mythological. It's
one of the great American stories, and it's not over yet, which makes
thank
it like
God.
I love the story where the big question is what's going to happen next. That's
hell
like
yeah.
That's the thing that propels every great narrative, and that's what I want to know about Mike Tyson. What's going to happen next?
Fucking
we're gonna conquer the world, buddy. Tyson
Alexander
Rex.
The Great, baby.
All day. We're not turning back,
Mike. Maybe you're so interested in Alexander the Great because you're the reincarnation.
No,
of
I don't know.
Whoa.
Boom! We're
listen,
done.
Close all the
gotta
loops.
Go.
Done.
Gotta, yeah, we better
close
go.
All the
it's lunchtime. We love you guys. Check
we
us out on YouTube. Subscribe to our channel.
Thank
I'm Evan Britton.
John.
That's Mike Tyson. This is John Heilman. We're out of here. Love y'all. Peace.